Hello, everybody. Welcome back to the Buddhist Center podcast with me, Chandradasa. And I'm delighted to be doing this podcast episode live from India, here at the Triratna land at Bodh Gaya in Bihar, in the kind of northeast of India. The land traditionally associated with the story of the Buddha, and particularly the Buddha's enlightenment. And we're here celebrating the International Triratna Buddhist Order, which is our context for this podcast and for stories of Buddhist life, I suppose, Buddhist practice, and what it is that lights up all sorts of amazing beings, some of whom you're going to meet in a minute, none of whom are from India. But we're here and people have gathered from all over the world, so it seemed a perfect opportunity to have a conversation in a mythic place about a mythic place. Everyone needs a mythic place, and we're going to talk today about a mythic place on the other side of the world, in Ireland. There are all sorts of historic slash mythical turning points associated with this place we're in. And what we're going to talk about today, the establishment of the first dedicated Triratna Buddhist retreat centre in Ireland, is another turning point, just like that. So let's meet our guests. You might have met our first guest before. She used to be part of the team at Dharma Chakra, who produce this podcast and the Buddhist Centre Online. The inimitable, wonderful, loveliest friend in the world, Sadhya Sihi.
Thanks, Chandradasa.
Hey.
I can rely on you for a very warm introduction.
I've always wanted to introduce you like that on the radio.
Thank you.
And next to Sadhya Sihi, we have Vara Bandhu, who's moonlighting from Future Dharma Fund, but also Dublin Buddhist Centre fundraiser extraordinaire.
Thank you. Thank you, Chandradasa. Great to be here.
Great to have you. And on my left, Vajrashura. Great friend, wonderful trustee of Dharma Chakra. He made me say that. And one of the kind of vision holders for this project, along with a whole team of people who we'll doubtless hear about.
Right. Thanks, Chandradasa. Hello, everyone listening to the podcast.
So I guess a good place to start with a podcast about a retreat center, which is kind of in a retreat center on the other side of the world, is if the currency here, if the thing that ties all together is that we make beautiful mythic spaces together. So Sadhya, why don't you give us an introduction to this place that we're going to talk about, and what does it mean to each of us?
Well, interesting you say that about making places of beauty. Our retreat centre has been given a name by Spadramati, who's Dublin Buddhist Centre's president, and the retreat centre will be called, well, is called Shubha Vihara, which means the abode of beauty.
And what does that mean to you? So it's, that's the translation as the abode of beauty, but what does that evoke for you?
Well, when Spadramati gave us the name, she linked it very much to Maitri, or to Metta, and said that when we practice Metta, we make everything really beautiful. And obviously, when you go on retreat, you dwell a lot on Metta, you practice, and that has an effect on the world around you. So in a way, what I think of this place is a place where we'll be practicing a lot of Metta and hopefully perfuming where we are, the place we're in, and then taking that back home with us in this sort of spirit of recognizing beauty in ourselves and in other people in the world.
That's pretty lovely. You can probably hear, if you're listening to this, laughter in the background. We're in a giant tent. Forgot to say that at the start. We're in a giant tent that's flapping in the wind, and you can hear the voices of people laughing delightedly in the distance, which reminds me a bit of what you're talking about. That's what happens when you go on retreat somewhere beautiful and a bit magical, and that takes you out of your normal life. You're just delightful. You can't help but laugh. Parabandhu, what's your take on Shubha Vihara as a mythic name for a mythic place?
What does it evoke for me?
What does it do to your heart?
I think for me it's something about having place of practice for our community of Buddhists and anyone who's open to that in the heart of the Irish countryside. There's something really magical for me about that, and something about also having a place that we keep going back to again and again, that just gets more and more imbued with our practice, with the practice of compassion and awareness of reality. And it just becomes deeper and more instilled with that. And a place where newcomers even can come along and just catch that really quickly. I suppose there's two things there. One is that it's in the middle of the Irish countryside. And so there's something about the context of the myth of Ireland, which I think we'll get into.
We're going to talk about myth.
We're going to talk about
the myth of Ireland.
We're going to definitely do that one. And we're in a particular tradition. It was founded by Sangharachita, an English Buddhist who spent
two decades in India, traveling around these parts where we are right now. Yeah. Went back to England in the 60s and decided the time was ripe for a new Buddhist movement. So there's a whole myth there as well. Mm-hmm. And he founded this new Buddhist movement. And it was because of his elucidation of the Buddha's teaching, the Dharma, to a Western audience that I personally was able to connect with Buddhism.
Right.
What, 12 years ago? At the Dublin Buddhist Center, meeting Vajrasuras at ISCE. And there's something about knowing that there's a place, so I'm very grateful to him, knowing that there will be a place in Ireland, a retreat center, home for the Sri Ratna Sangha, where there's a picture of Bhante on the shrine. Because there are some other Buddhist retreat centers in Ireland, but they're not of the tradition that has really inspired me, that has become a home for me.
Yeah, so you're passing it on. And you, Vajrasura, the place of beauty, how does that sing to you?
Yeah, so there's a couple of different levels maybe. And when I think of beauty, I think beauty as a concept in Buddhism really clicked for me one retreat where it was a winter retreat many years ago now. And I remember people coming, myself included, and we all looked really tired and haggard after Christmas. We all had too much to eat and too much television and too much Mary Poppins and the like. And we were all there and I was kind of like, oh, I don't want to be on retreat. But we had a week-long retreat and it was such a good retreat. And by the end of the retreat, people just looked really beautiful. And there's something of that quality of Shubhad. People just looked really bright, really radiant, really happy, actually, and at their best. And for me, that was an insight moment. I think I wasn't even ordained at the time. It was just an insight moment. Oh, this is kind of the beauty of the spiritual life that we're trying to get back to, in a way, so much of our lives. And for me, I want Shubhavihara to be a place where people go and just connect with the most beautiful in life, the deepest, richest, most wonderful meaning. Bhante Sangharakshita, our founder, is very clear that beauty is a path. Beauty is a path to enlightenment. Mm. That by practicing the path, you see things as more beautiful. You become more beautiful, not in a conventional way necessarily, although that would be nice, but more just to become a very attractive, loving person and people around you. Sangha becomes an attractive, loving place. Yeah, I just think that's what I really want, a place where people can go and experience the beauty of the spiritual life and the beauty of spiritual friendship.
Yeah. Now, there is this bit of the Buddhist tradition, isn't there, as well, where part of what we're doing is exploring how can we see more deeply into the nature of things. And it's said, isn't it, in the later tradition, that when you see the impermanence of things and when you see that things don't have any fixedness, and when you see the relationship between that and your own holding on to things and your own pushing away of things and the fact that hurts. When you relax into all and you see something more clearly, you start to also be aware of Shubha as a kind of characteristic of reality almost. Yeah. And it's like your faculty for discerning that in a very complex world, in a difficult world, gets somehow more refined. Just from what you were saying there, it sounded like you're going to create a place where people can go and tune into that. They can practice it. You have to practice seeing beauty.
Yeah, because it reminds me of a story about the Buddha where some people were accusing him of disregarding the beautiful and rejecting the beautiful. And his reply was, no, that's not true. I teach people what is actually beautiful. So in a way, that's another part of the vision of Shubhavihara, connecting people with what is actually beautiful rather than what we're told is beautiful in the everyday world, which often isn't, to be honest.
So if you're listening to this, you're probably not Irish. Some of you will be Irish, but a lot of you won't be. I live in a place in the United States where as soon as people hear my accent, about 90% of people say, oh, you're from Ireland. And I say, no,
Ireland.
No, I'm not very Bundy. No, I'm not. So, as soon as I tell people that I'm Scottish or they assume that I'm Irish, they immediately say, my grandmother's from Ireland or my cousins are from Ireland or I've always wanted to go to Ireland. So it's almost like, at least in some bits of the world, Ireland is already a mythic realm. Is the whole idea of the Irish saving civilization at a certain point, the Irish diaspora that's gone out. And I wanted to come back to the mythic bit of that, or stay with the mythic bit of that, because a lot of people who have some distant relationship to Ireland culturally will be aware of old stories like St. Patrick driving the snakes out of Ireland, etc. And when I was thinking about this podcast and we were talking about it a bit before, I was thinking, well, in a way, you're establishing a place, like an abode, where you're going to be making the stories for the next 1,000 years that will animate, that will reanimate Irish culture, hopefully in some way, and touch Irish mythology even. Maybe you're going to bring the snakes back to life. I was just remembering that our teacher, Urgen Sangharakshita, he was very strong in saying that to establish a real Western modern Buddhism, you needed to basically become pagan again. And it just seems like the perfect opportunity in a way is to go right at the heart of that myth.
Yeah, well, Interestingly, in college, my first primary degree was in English and history. And the history part of that, one module I studied was early Irish Brehon law. So Brehon just basically means old Irish for judge. And there's something really interesting about revisiting Irish history from the very beginning. So Brehon law was around the 7th, 8th century-ish. And you can see the kind of Irish society back then, which then became overlaid with Christianity. And you can see that actually in quite a lot of Irish myths as well, how they originated kind of pagan myths, and then they're sort of interspersed or almost taken over by Christianity. We were actually chatting ourselves, myself and Varabandhu and Vajrasura, about our memories, trying to remember some of the myths that we were brought up with. And quite a few of them towards the end, you have some figures who are then baptized by an Irish saint. And I think there's something for us as Sri Ratna Buddhists that we can maybe even learn from that, because I think it was quite effective. When Christianity came to Ireland, they didn't just sort of try and roll out a whole new thing altogether. They took what was already there and they made it relevant or made it live. And for us, obviously, Ireland has such a long history with Christianity and Catholicism, particularly in the south of Ireland, that trying to sort of pick up Christian myths, very Christian myths, just won't really work for people. But we can certainly go back to things like, well, interestingly enough, recently in Ireland, they introduced a public holiday for St. Bridget. But actually, if you know anything about St. Bridget, there's actually before St. Bridget, there was the goddess Bridget. So that's something we can connect in with and get behind. And, you know, it ties in very much into what, as you say, Bhante was talking about, coming back to sort of the pagan myths underneath.
And don't they call it Bridget's Day? So they've tried to actually allow for the more secular aspect of it. Whereas, you know, 50 years ago, when they introduced a public holiday, it's definitely going to be a saint day, a Christian day. Yeah. So it's good that they sort of have seen that there's that pre-Christian, they sort of recognise that. Isn't she linked to some sort of other figure, Sheila na Gcaoi?
Sheila na Gcaoi. Sheila na Gcaoi.
Yeah.
She's a fertility goddess. I don't know. I mean, I don't know that I particularly know very much about Bridget. I know more about the myths that come about Saint Bridget. There's just this famous story where she sold her father's sword to provide food for people. You know, that's a really interesting
story. And she established a monastery in Ireland as well. There's a story where she was allowed to take as much land for the monastery as her cloak could cover, but her cloak miraculously spread to cover the whole big field, and she got the whole field, this massive space for building of a monastery, isn't it? Or an equivalent of a monastery back then here.
Yeah. I'm not 100% sure about this, but it might even be the whole county of Kildare.
Oh, it's like the whole county. Yeah.
I mean, that's a classic example of merging sort of Christian growth of Christian faith in Ireland with this sort of magical story, kind of like a city. So a city in Buddhism, in, I suppose in Tibetan Buddhism, is essentially a magic power that a great practitioner will have gained.
I went to St. Bridget's Primary School, so now I'm all kind of nostalgic about that. This may be a good time to talk about Lough Derger.
Oh yeah, so I suppose on the theme of the stories that are in the land of Ireland and the myths that inform us, we realised that the location for this new retreat centre is in the west of Ireland, but it's very close to this lake called Lough Derg, which is, I think it's the biggest lake in the country. It's not certainly on the longest river, the River Shannon. I never questioned the nomenclature, the etymology of this name until we had this retreat centre, and it started dawned on me. I think it was when we'd gone up, myself and some of the other guys from our Buddhist community, gone up there to have a look around the property that we bought, and we were going to now renovate, an earthen renovate. And we went for a little excursion to this scenic spot to look out over the lake. And the lake is just beautiful, nestled in these rolling hills of East Clare in the west of Ireland, a soft landscape. And so I looked it up in Wikipedia later. Lough Derg refers to the word Jarig, which is Gaelic for Irish, and refers to this deity, this pre-Christian deity, who was associated with redness, with fecundity and abundance and fertility. And of course, there's that connection with Buddhist iconography, the Buddhist mythical figure of Amitabha, who's obviously associated with red and associated with the Western sky. So we thought that was quite, well, I personally thought that was quite a lovely piece of...
That's very cool.
It's very cool.
Okay.
And it's in the west of Ireland as well.
Yeah.
I could make a terrible joke here. It's very Finn McCool.
No.
Wow.
Anyone?
We could tell you some stories about Finn McCool.
Wait, tell us some stories about Finn McCool. We're going to make a film.
Jokes. You're going to have to.
Yeah. Okay. I'm going to make Finn McCool jokes, and you're going to have to tell stories about Curlin and Finn McCool.
Maybe Varda Shura knows the story of Finn McCool.
Well, there's lots of different stories of Finn McCool, but one of the ones. So, Cú Chulainn was this legendary warrior, and he was a young man. He was heading over to this gathering of elders. They thought everyone had arrived, so they closed the gates of the fortress and left. Cú left his dog outside, and Cú Chulainn, that he wasn't known as that before that, but I can't remember.
Satanta.
Satanta, that's right, yes, it's Satanta. He was running along with his hurley, which is kind of like an Irish version of a baseball, we could say. That's kind of blasphemous to Irish people to say that. It looks like a baseball.
A baseball is like the American version of a hurley.
That's better range. Yeah. They copied us. And balancing on a long stick called a hurley. And the dog attacked him, and he took his hurley and whacked the slitter down and killed the dog. It went into his throat and choked him. And Cú was very upset. So Cú promised, and as a result, to guard the property of Cú, and he became Cú Chulainn, the Hound of Chulainn. So that's where he gets his name from. So there's a lot of warrior stories in Irish culture like that. And then Finn McCool, who you talked about, the earliest story I know of him was that he came across this chap on the river fishing for the Salmon of Knowledge. It was Fiacre, wasn't it? And Fiacre was looking for the Salmon of Knowledge for a long, long time. He had just caught him when Finn McCool came along. And apparently, if you eat the fish, it's not very Buddhist in this regard, but if you eat the fish, you gain a world of knowledge. And so he's cooking the fish, and he asks Finn to look after the fish and keep turning it and cooking it. And Finn isn't sure if it's getting overcooked, so he presses it just to see if it's cooked, and it burns his finger. And he puts his finger in his mouth, and he absorbs a huge amount of knowledge. And then the old man comes back and realizes what's happened, so makes him eat the rest of the fish. And as a result, he gains all this knowledge that helps him to go on to be a great leader in Ireland. So that's the story of Finn McCool. Have you heard the story?
So I guess we've heard all these mythic figures, these wonderful stories. Some people have heard about, maybe for some people it's the first time. It's really exciting stuff. But in a way, this is the material you've got to transform, isn't it? Like, this is one of the jobs as Buddhists in our particular culture. We do it in our own practice, but we also do it together in community, and we send that out almost like a wave out into the culture. That's the raw material, is this amazing, rich culture that's already been overlaid at least once with a different mythology, some of which in a way we're explicitly rejecting and saying that this is not the way. So how do you see this as, or any of you, how do any of you see this as the stuff that's going to fuel the work of Shubha Vihara and the Dharma in Ireland?
Yeah, well, I'm just saying that Cú Chulainn was a warrior. And in Buddhism, actually, this might be a surprise to some people, but a warrior, a spiritual warrior, is very much valued. I think in the West, sometimes we overemphasize the more receptive, peaceful element of Buddhism, and there's lots of images of lotuses and that kind of thing. But actually, like the Buddha himself said, monks and nuns, we must be warriors. We must be warriors and fight. And he meant that we should fight greed, hatred, and delusion in ourselves. And he said, it's better than conquering 1,000 people in battle is to conquer oneself, in the sense of, you know, working with the mind and learning to tame the mind in a way. And that's been reflected in our name. So my name is Shura, which means warrior, Vajra Shura, Vajra warrior. And for me, a warrior or a hero is someone who serves the bigger community, who has the energy to meet the forces of society and bring the Dharma into those areas. So I think we could tap into that for sure.
Well, you've got a battle-tested mythic culture already.
Exactly. Yeah.
A lot of the Irish myths are around battles. Anybody else want to contribute to that bit of?
Well, I guess I could just say, in the history of our Sangha, which was set up in 1991, there is a bit of a tradition of trying to speak to the local, the mythic dimension of being Irish and bringing that into the Dharma life. So I know in the early days, which I wasn't around for, I know there was people were doing things like wearing green cloaks and circumambulating places like, I'm not sure if it was Newgrange or the Hill of Tara.
Both, I think.
Both places, which are, well, they're very important cultural sites. Newgrange in particular is this large passage tomb, which was built before the pyramids of Egypt. They will always tell you that when you go on a tour of Newgrange. We're very proud of that. And what's amazing about Newgrange actually is just that it's in alignment, the passage tomb itself is in alignment with the sun coming in the morning of the winter solstice. And a few days around that, the light travels up the tomb and illuminates the whole inner passage.
Yeah.
So it's a very, very mythic place. And if you've ever gone there, there's a real energy and aliveness. And maybe just for me, I'll just say, but that is what I would love Shubha Vihara to be, to have that kind of sacredness. We don't actually know why Newgrange was built. I mean, historians and archaeologists have ideas of who might be buried in there or why they might have built this. The fact that they built it, they didn't even have wheels back then. It was these giant stoves that are decorating the outside of the passage. They were rolled up on logs from rivers. They can tell that they were come from miles and miles away. So we don't really know why Newgrange was built. And if, frankly, how they did it is also incredible. But I'd love to think that Shuva Vihara will be a place like that for generations to come. It will be a monument to what we're trying to do and very much part of our culture, of our heritage in Ireland.
Yeah.
And can I add, there was a really interesting thing that we went there on the winter solstice, at ICE and a few others, and Varabandhu and a few others, and there was at least 2,000 people out there celebrating the solstice, which shows that there is a real appetite for this kind of return to paganism in Ireland.
Yeah.
People are really, really interested in this, and I think the Shuva Vihara project will really speak to them as well.
I'm really glad you mentioned the Newgrange thing. Quite a long time ago now, Brandon Stewart and I went to Newgrange and Hill of Tara, and I'd heard about it and I'd read about it in books and stuff. There was something about going there, and Hill of Tara is where the kings were crowned, right, in Ireland.
The High Kings.
The High Kings were crowned. But when we were in the Grange itself, and we saw the passage that the light comes in, I remember standing there thinking, the darkness is beautiful. When you're standing in that space, the darkness is beautiful and the light is beautiful. And there's something about it. You're not trying to cover over all of that history and all of that depth and all of that dark in a way, but there's something else can be illuminated. And I suppose that's what the Buddhist tradition does at its best, right? It's enlightenment is something that it doesn't just negate. It's a real lighting up of something.
And I think there's parallels with Padmasambhava going to Tibet as well, in a way. And we've been quite inspired by the myth of Padmasambhava, where he doesn't try and destroy the local deities. He brings them on side. He learns their names and then enlists them in building the monasteries there. And so I think we want to tap into those energies in Ireland as well and get them on our side. And I don't know, I find the myth of Padmasambhava very inspiring in this regard.
Yeah. I mean, one of the things that struck me having conversations with each of you about this before and listening now is you haven't kind of got it all completely worked out, but you definitely are onto a good thing. Mm. You can tell when people are onto a good thing, and there's all these kind of auspicious things happening around Lough Derg, and just the fact that it's you, actually it's you as a group of people who have got this really heartfelt connection to the mythology of Ireland. It's not like you've gone away and thought, well, okay, how do we tie this up as Buddhists? This is an expression of your Irishness, and the stuff that presumably brought you to the Dharma in the first place is alive, that kind of love and that investment in something together. I mean, you're a team, right? I suppose that's the thing I've been thinking about, is presumably the business of starting this retreat centre isn't all sitting around talking about Kavala and the magic and mystery, the spreadsheets.
And maybe a spreadsheet or two, yeah, and a few rolling minutes of documents of minutes pretty much every week, Thursday mornings, 10 to 11, give or take.
Usually a bit longer.
Maybe a bit longer. And usually maybe allowing for tea to be made as well. But for 3 years now, obviously a lot of that is, you know, figuring out spreadsheets, looking at to-do lists, who's going to do that, who's going to do what. But then a lot of it is, just reconnecting with the vision and why are we doing this? Why do we meet every Thursday morning? Why do we want to do this? And connecting with that sense of there's this amazing thing that we could manifest. We have a dream that we want to make real. The fact of having a home for the Irish Sangha just really fills my heart right now, just thinking about it. Yeah. I think for me, personally speaking, very soon after coming along to the Buddhist Center and finding the effects that the Dharma had on my life and realizing this was a community of people and practitioners that could really transform me and that I wanted to be part of helping to transform the world with, I kind of realized at some point we're going to build a retreat center together. And I didn't tell any of these guys about that, but I kind of knew at some point we're going to build a retreat center together.
Hmm. It's amazing, isn't it, when you start to dream something into existence like this with people. Presumably that does ask questions of each of you again. It's like, why am I doing any of this? Like, what are you giving back to your culture? What are you giving back to your own country, your own society?
Well, coming back to your point, Chandradasa, about not having it all worked out, I think that's probably fair to say that a couple of years ago at the Dublin Buddhist Centre, I think it was just people teach around the Dublin Buddhist Centre went to the LBC for some teacher training and visioning. And at that time, what our vision was, I can't remember what year, was it 2019?
Just before COVID.
Yeah, 2019.
So that's in London, yeah?
The London Buddhist Centre, yes. The London Buddhist Centre were running a visioning and teacher training workshop at that point, we came up with the vision of expanding our centre, which is the Dumb Buddha Centre, into the property next to us, or exploring that at least. And so that was kind of what was, at that point in time, what we were picturing. And then very unexpectedly, this idea emerged, which really was the brainchild of Jyotika. So Jyotika is an old member from Ireland, as some people might know. And basically, he just saw this opportunity. So Sangashura had been renting a place just outside Killaloe in County Clare, a place called Ballina. And the people who owned that property wanted to sell, and they were offering it to Sangashura at a very reasonable rate. Sangashura wasn't in the position to buy it, but Jyotika just thought about it and he thought, well, this could be an opportunity for us to buy a retreat centre. And I think at that point, the place that we'd normally been going on retreat, which is a place in County Cavan and Sandville House, which was an old hostel, a lot of people in our Sangha who have been around for many years would have a very fond memory of that place. Over the years, I think we started using it since Shirana had a presence in Ireland. That was sold. That was sale. The people who owned that were moving and put it on the market. And we weren't in a position to buy that. So I guess that was sort of at the back of our minds. Our usual place where we were renting was taken off the market. And it's been hard finding other places to rent. Jyotika saw the opportunity there and he made this presentation to the Dumb Buddha Centre Council. And at that time, I think it was just in the months running up to before I started as the chair. So I was taking over from Yanadara. And I'll have to admit that my initial thoughts were like, oh no, not a really big, stressful, complicated project. I haven't even in the door yet. I don't even know what it means to be chair. Never mind.
It was always going to happen.
Never mind be involved in a retreat centre project. But actually, I just had to keep coming back to our Sangha really needs this. It's not a fanciful idea that wouldn't that be nice, Usher, give it a go. It was like, we actually really need this. And I suppose maybe fast forward to 2.5 years later, we went on the longest retreat we've had since COVID. It's our last winter retreat, which is a week long in 2019-2020 over the New Year's. That was our last long retreat. Myself and Varabandhu and Prasanna Deva just ran the longest retreat, which was 5 days, and another rented place. There was something, just something about that. Well, I was saying it to the, both of them after the retreat. There was such an atmosphere of Sangha that made me realize that, well, one, the winter retreat in particular, because it's a long retreat, is kind of an institution in Ireland. And in fact, going on retreats in our Sangha are kind of institutions. One of the things I've learned from going to the chairs meetings is that there's many Sanghas who only just go on a Sangha retreat maybe once or twice a year. But in Ireland, I guess because we're on an island, generally speaking, we would have about 9 retreats a year. So when we weren't able to have retreats during COVID, that was a huge blow to our Sangha. And you could actually feel a loss of depth of practice because we don't really have contexts like team-based right livelihoods. We did for a time have the Evolution Shop, but obviously that closed many years before Wimpers trading stopped. So any context for working in teams like that is in the centre. And there's a couple of communities as well, but really in a way retreats are our context for going deep. So we just had this flavour of that. I mean, you probably agree, Varabandhu, coming back from the winter retreat, I could just feel like, ah, something has come back and this is going to have a really positive effect. And hey, wait till we get the retreat centre up and running. What's that going to be like here?
And what's interesting about that retreat you referred to, because that thread we talked about that's run through the Irish Sangha since we started the community here in the 90s, a thread of connecting with pre-Christian myths, connecting with the earth, connecting with the mystery and magic of the land, connecting with Druidism. We talked about the green cloaks because they were sort of cloaks, weren't they? They were sort of a way to have a sense of Druidism and paganism and connect that with our Buddhist practice. That was very much part of the theme, wasn't it, of that winter retreat? And probably not for the first time, because those winter retreats are particularly strong practices of myth. What we were looking at was the life of liberation of Padmasambhava. But it's very much getting people to think about demons and having a sense of the non-corporeal entities. Well, we did, what's the sutta we were doing at the beginning of the...
The Ratna Sutta, yeah. We were, at the very beginning, we were making a lot of effort to dedicate the space and to really invoke the energies and to get them behind us as we were.
The local gods.
The local gods. Presences. Yes, exactly. Yeah. All of them before we embarked on invoking Padmasambhava. So that was quite strong. And then towards the end, we had this New Year's Eve ritual, which we did that rededication again before we spent the whole evening. doing various rituals involving fire and other things.
So this is, I mean, one of the things that strikes me listening, people who don't know your situation, who don't know all the sort of detail of what it's like to run a Buddhist center and try and do it in a culture, I'm assuming the thing that's going to resonate with them about this when they hear this story is that it's very palpable, again, listening to all of you, that the world is alive, right? That's what you're doing, and this place is alive. Even that thing of like dedicating it and involving the tree spirits and the water spirits and the fire spirits and all the elements, that kind of thing. When you put that out into the universe, you get a response. We talked this, didn't we, on the bus from Gaia Airport to this retreat center here. There's a call and response, isn't there? When you put something out, people respond. I'm just aware you're telling people about this retreat center. And one of the things that I remember most strongly from when you used to dance, he was the story of how you actually raised money for the Dublin sector recently. And like, you had to put out a big call into the universe and have a certain kind of faith that it would be answered. And it was totally transfiguring what actually happened.
I think it was the end of 2023 where we were, well, Vajrasura looks after our accounts at the centre, and we realised that, well, having come out of COVID, our financial situation was a bit precarious, our reserves were very low, and we realised we were heading for, I think it was a 20 grand loss, 20,000 euro loss, which is quite large. And it wasn't a problem in that year because we had built up some reserves over COVID. The government gave us some support. But we knew if that carried on to the next year, we'd be in a situation we'd have to let people go. And obviously this was running alongside the fact we were also doing fundraising for a retreat centre. And we were, the three of us were meeting at that time, as Svarabanda mentioned, our weekly meetings. There just came a moment where it was like, I'm sorry, we can't actually talk about the retreat centre. We have this kind of crushing feeling in relation to the centre itself. So we really had to just put down the retreat centre and look at how we can address that situation. Because if the centre, the Dublin Buddhist Centre, isn't functioning, well, then it's not really possible for us to really contemplate turning a property into a retreat centre. And we're so fortunate that Varabandhu was in our midst. I have to say, I have very little experience of fundraising, so it was quite daunting. But it's so amazing just to be able to say, well, one, to say it to the people you're working with, hey, look, we have a problem, and what are we going to do? To have people not just turn away from it and say, well, that's your issue or anything like that, to really take it on, throw around some ideas and come up with a plan that felt doable, even if it was intimidating, the idea of having to go back to the Sangha and say, I know we've been trying to raise money for a retreat centre, but now we're going to have to turn the attention back to the Dublin Buddhist Centre. But in a way, it was just one of those situations where there was a wonderful opportunity. I remember having this great chat with Maitri Sara, who is the chair of the Birmingham Centre. They had done phone campaigns, so I had a great chat with her, hearing about how they did that. Also, obviously, the support of Future Dharma Fund, who were willing to allow Varabandhu to work on this appeal. And it was an opportunity then for our Sangha to... We asked a few mitras who would they be willing to get involved in doing this. And again, none of them had any experience of fundraising, but they really... I guess they really value our Sangha. It's meant an awful lot to them. So they were willing to put themselves forward to be the people on the phones, coached by Varabandhu, to ask.
Actually, not only did they not have any experience fundraising, they were terrified of the idea of fundraising. But they, despite the fact that they were terrified, they each said yes to me and you. Myself and Sadaisi were the people who rang him. And he said, I really don't want to do this, Varabandhu, but I'll do it because I can hear that the centre needs it and I care about the Dublin Buddhist Centre. They cared so much about the fact that we were in trouble. We went to them and said, we're in trouble, we need help. And they said, well, yeah, we'll help. And we got them together. We basically, for 5 nights, they gathered each evening. They left behind our busy lives, many of them their family lives. They arranged dinners to be made for their kids so they could come over to our house and ring the Sangha. And what happened was, a sort of magic happened, actually. It was, I'm so moved when I think about it. A sort of magic happened whereby instead of them feeling like they were going and asking something of people, we started to soon realize that actually each time they made a phone call to someone in our community, they were creating this wonderful connection and they weren't asking something. They were giving people this opportunity to connect back after this connection and this integration that happened with the lockdown to really galvanize the Sangha. And I remember having this, myself and Sadaisi went for a cup of tea, I think on the morning of the fourth day, And I remember sharing this image with you that I had, I think, previous that night as I lay in bed, wired, completely wired from these amazingly high energy evenings of ringing like 100 people and having this image of the Sangha, our community of people, being like one of those sort of phone grid images, like a network where you show like all these wires going across the city, but the light on those wires being dim. But each time we made that phone call and had that wonderful conversation, the light kind of getting brighter and brighter, and the whole grid getting brighter and brighter. Just sort of brighter with love and brighter with gratitude and generosity. Yes. So it became this sort of alchemy.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, then there's a two dimension to this. One was the mythic dimension of all of this, and the other was the actual reality that we raised. We met our target. I have to say, at the beginning, I was thinking, well, our target was to raise 20,000 euro annually. So basically, we're looking for recurring donations. I thought to myself, well, I know Varavandhu's keen on this, but I think if we get 10,000, maybe that will be amazing.
I didn't set the target.
Well, you did. That was because we needed it. That was because we needed it. But I wasn't sure that that would be at all possible. Then we did it. It was incredible. I mean, one, it was financially a relief. But second of all, probably even more importantly, it was just that sense of, it was a reminder. I mean, like what you said about the disconnect over COVID, it was like, no, this place is really important to a lot of people. And when you ask them, they will respond.
Yeah.
They'll respond. And I think for me, that gives me faith in relation to the retreat center, because that's a much larger target we're trying to raise for our Sangha. But I just believe we'll get there. We'll get there.
Yeah.
I don't fully know how, but I don't need to know how. I just know that we'll get there. Because it's needed.
Yeah.
Well, ultimately, because it's
pretty clear, isn't it? It's all arising together. You're kind of making it happen, but also they're making it happen. It's like you're all together in it. So Vajrasura, hearing all these stories about these quite intricate conditions coming together, almost impossibly for the arising of this beautiful realm that's starting to take shape. There's loads still to do. Don't quite know how you're going to get there, but you're definitely going to get there because something's already in motion at quite deep level by the sounds of it, you know, almost like seeping down through all the layers of Irishness and Irish history and Irish mythology. If you have a vision of like 5 to say 25 years time, what is the experience you want to bring into being for people at the retreat center? What will happen there? What's the magic that will happen there?
Yeah, well, I think to look forward, I firstly look back, and I look back at my own experiences of being on retreat. And being on retreat with the Irish Sangha, I've just had some of the richest times in my life. It's great being on retreat here. It's great being on retreat in the UK. It's great being on retreat in Spain. But there is something about being on retreat in the Irish landscape for me that's very important. And I made a conscious decision a few years ago that I often do solitary retreats every year. And I made a conscious decision each year now to spend as many of those in Ireland, because there's something about the landscape that speaks to me more than the landscape of Spain or wherever. And that's, you know, there's nothing, no criticism of Spain or anything, or UK, or, but I just love being on retreat in the Irish countryside. So what I'd like in the future going forward, in 5 years' time and 10 years' time, is just for us to have a place where we really feel a home there, and there's something of the energy there that is just, there's something magical there. And I've already felt that in the place that will become Shivavihara. You know, when Sangha Shuri used to live there, he's a very close friend of mine. We even shared 4 months in a hut together in the Spanish mountains when I was being ordained back in 2007. So I visited him quite a few times in that house. So I have a long history with the place. And I remember not long after we purchased the house, I was down there, I think on my own. And I just had this very strong intuitive sense of the place as somewhat alive. And I had a feeling of something was very pleased that we were there. So, and I can't explain it. I'm, you know, I'm a scientist by training, so I'm not given to huge flights of fancy. But I did have that feeling very strongly that something was very pleased that we were there, and it was very welcoming. That, and some of that was Sangha Shura's weight of practice that he'd done there. He'd been living there for many years. But there's something deeper. It felt deep down, almost in the earth there. And a few people have said that being there. So I don't know, maybe my vision from the future comes from that it's somewhere where people can go and experience a deep, deep plugged inness to the native energies and to the Dharma, and the native energies being perfectly blended together, because native energies on their own are unruly and not necessarily always positive. We were just talking earlier, a lot of the native Irish stories end in people being chopped up by swords and stuff, you know. And that's not exactly what we're aiming for, but it's a kind of a blending of the old and the new. So just something about that that I'd like in 10, 15 years' time, that people can come there and just experience a deep-rootedness and the pleasure of being together. And the other thought I had is that I just remember back in 2007, 2008, when I returned from my ordination course, I came back to discover, I had known it was coming, but we'd purchased our first Buddhist center. And up to that point, we'd been renting in various places around the city. And I really wasn't expecting how different it would feel to own the center as opposed to just have a place you're renting. Because it meant, even in the middle of the city, it felt that you could put your roots down really deeply. Mm. And that wasn't something that I decided that we were going to do and that we'd purchase the place. It just felt like that. It was finally a place where we could really put our roots down. And I think with Shubhavihara, when it really comes into existence, when we've finished the building work or it's well underway and it's a functioning retreat center, those roots will go down very deep and we'll never have to worry about maybe we can't rent it this weekend or anything like that, you know?
And then you can start thinking about 100 years' time, 500 years' time.
Well, that's what I'd like to see.
Great monasteries of Ireland being restored.
That's what I'd like to see, yeah, exactly.
Range.
And maybe in 5,000 years' time, they'll be figuring out what the people do here. It's very mysterious.
I mean, I just add, I think this being the moment, this being the historic moment, the moment is right. All things are sort of coming together right now. The serendipity of being offered this place at a really reasonable price because the owners really liked what Sangashura had been doing for 10 years. They respected the fact that he had put together a place of practice. He has a small Sangha down there. He's been chugging away, keeping the flames alive of Buddhism in this small group down there. So huge thanks actually to him and those guys who showed up every week and put together a shrine space in the middle of this town. But there's also something happening in the Irish Sangha across the island right now, where there's all these little groups popping up that were kind of there, but they're much more alive now. And actually, when you were talking about the Hill of Tara, I was thinking about, sorry, I'm going off on one here now, but I was thinking about also on the Hill of Tara, is it summer solstice or maybe it's the equinox where they light fires or something. Oh. The Hill of Tara is one of the hills they light a fire on. Bealtaine, sorry, yeah.
It's in May.
May, yeah, the May Festival. And I had this idea that maybe a point at which maybe we could incorporate that into one of our annual rituals.
Crown to the ICE here at the top of the
Bealtaine.
Yes.
The greatest thing.
The queen of the
pirate queen of Buddhism.
The pirate queen drawing your whale of Buddhism.
Won't let that go to my head.
Darkly staying in.
Well, it's great, isn't it? Because in a way, historically, if that happens, people will look back on it and they say, oh, the establishment of the Buddhist religion in Ireland, that's not quite what you're doing, is it? It's like there's something that helps people live their life. In a country that needs a new path, you've got something and it works. Mm. And it's, in a way, it's not much more complicated than that, but it does touch down into all this depth practice. If you're listening to this and it's resonating, whether it's resonating as a Buddhist practitioner or just someone who stirs your Irish blood or your granny's Irish blood, or you've heard the tales and they touch something because you think, actually, yeah, in my culture, I'd love to see something like this happen. Well, you know, wherever you're listening, you can actually help. You can actually help with this because it's going to take a lot of work and a lot of love and a lot of money to make this project happen. So, Brabandu, why don't you tell us a little bit about how somebody who's moved by the prospect of a beautiful realm for Ireland can help bring it into being?
Yeah, so this project is costing the Dublin Buddhist Centre. This is the most audacious capital project our community has embarked on, well, since buying the centre, but it's even bigger than buying our own centre. It's pretty bold, and fair play to Sadaisi for agreeing to it as the first big task of her chairship. It's a 600,000 euro project, but we've been so blessed with support from near and far in getting us to where we are with that now. So Windhorse Trust, and many of the listeners will know about, were able to step forward and give us a loan to make up most of the purchase price. So that was 250,000 a loan we got from them. We were so short. Then amazingly, Vajashura, would you want to say a little bit about Fred, who we're calling Fred, the secret donor?
Yeah, so an order member I know stepped up. Well, I'd heard that he was looking for some ways to help the movement because he had come into some inheritance, and through a mutual friend we connected up. I know who he is, but he wants to stay anonymous, so we have the name Fred for him, so we talk about Fred. Basically, he had received an inheritance. His mother, who had passed on, had given the money to him. She had herself received the money from someone else, a neighbor who she'd been helping out. She hadn't known that this neighbor had money, and when that neighbor died, she left Fred's mother lots of money, and Fred then has used that money to help build a retreat center in Ireland. And I was chatting to Fred recently, and he was saying that he gave away basically almost all the money he inherited, and he gave it to us interest-free, which is a huge donation, and he only received back the money that he needs to live. We, in effect, repay him that money, and then he can live very simply as a Buddhist in the UK somewhere. So very inspiring story from Fred, very, very generous.
That gave us enough then to be able to buy this 4-bedroom house and 2 acres. But of course, it's not a retreat center. We need to do a lot of work to make it a functioning retreat center with enough bedrooms, toilet facilities, and a custom-built shrine room. We want to have a beautiful shrine space which looks out over the western skies, over the rolling hills landscape of East Clare. And we've estimated 3 years ago that that would cost 270,000 euros. And we turned then to our Sangha, to our community. We turned to our community and said, look, can you help us do this? I mean, the response has been just so wonderful, so generous. We've raised an awful lot of that. If you think this is something you would really like to see happen, we need your help to make it happen. Just go to dublinbuddhistcenter.org/dream. We're suggesting a donation of 1,000 euros, which you could give up front or over the course of 2 or 3 years, but give what you can, give as much as you can. Thank you.
Raise the money.
Raise the money, yeah. Yeah, just do it.
Pop Gilbert,
yeah, yeah.
Live Aid. Raise the money. Don't go to the pub. Give the money to the Shubha Vihara project.
Yeah, yeah, in whatever way you can. Yeah, 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 just raise it, yeah. Just give something up. Give something up. dublinbuddhistcenter.org/dream.
We will put that in the show notes. dublinbuddhistcenter.org/dream. And basically, you can do this. You can help make it happen. These things, they just manifest magically. And who knows what can happen? Somebody might be listening to this. They might feel inspired to go and, I don't know, run a marathon, get all their friends to give them a bit of money. Adds up to 1,000 euro really quickly. Send it to you. And some magic happens. Maybe they'll never go to the retreat center. Maybe they will go to the retreat center someday. Make their own little pilgrimage to it. Go to the country of their forebears, forefathers and foremothers.
Everyone's welcome, no matter what your background, even if you're unfortunate enough not to be Irish.
That's right. Well, listen, let's round this conversation off with a look at the future, because in a way we've talked a lot about the present moment with this project. We've talked a lot about the roots into the past, into the deep past and the deep mythology of Ireland. It strikes me that, you know, just from this conversation, Ireland has gone through some big changes and we've evoked them. You've got our whole culture moving from paganism into sedimentary layers of Christianity. That's all started to dissolve and crumble. There's been some big stories around that. Ireland's moved from being the poor person of Europe to being the Celtic tiger of Europe. That seems to be changing as well. So what are the Dharma opportunities for you guys founding a new tradition in Ireland, setting up a new bit of the culture?
Yeah, so over the years, it's been really interesting watching the development of the connection of the Irish culture and Buddhism. So when we first opened, we weren't even called the Dublin Buddhist Centre. We were called the Dublin Meditation Centre because the Sangapala who founded it was so worried that people would be put off by the idea of Buddhism. And when I started working for the Buddhist Centre around 2001, 2002, we were still called the Meditation Centre. And then one day someone on a meditation course or a Buddhism course is saying, wow, this Buddhism sounds so interesting. Where's the nearest Buddhist Centre? So we realised the time is right to change things over to the Dublin Buddhist Centre and be much more open about it. What I've noticed is at different times during the Celtic Tiger, everyone was coming into us really stressed from overwork. And then since the crash, people have been just much more interested in meaning and Buddhism. And I think the old forms of belief and certainty have just crumbled and fallen away, like so much of Western Christianity. And people are really, really hungry now for a new, deep source of meaning that Buddhism can offer.
Well, I guess my experience of growing up in Ireland is that I'm living in a very changed Ireland. When I was probably about 15 in secondary school, we had this debate in English class around the divorce referendum at the time. And I think I was given the position of arguing for divorce. But I remember, like, at the time in Ireland, that was a really live question, the scandal of the idea of there being divorce, and never mind various other things. But over the years, things have changed quite considerably, so much so that many people found the same-sex marriage referendum like an incredible thing to have happened, given our history with Catholicism and the nature of Ireland being so inward-looking to a certain point. And I think in our society more generally, it's much more multicultural than it has been. Ireland has a very long history of people emigrating from Ireland. And more recently, we started seeing people coming to Ireland, which for quite a while was kind of slightly astounding to many of us, the idea of people coming to Ireland. And more recently, again, I think in terms of the Sangha, well, there's been opportunities arising for us to make connections. I mean, sometimes, you know, you might have an idea of what you'd like to do, and then other times opportunities emerge. And just last year, towards the end of last year, we got an unexpected email from a member of the Irish Ambedkarite group in Ireland. You know, it's kind of really interesting being here talking about that. So obviously there's a third of our Triratna order are based in India. Many of them are Ambedkarites. So Dr. Ambedkar is a very important figure for our Indian brothers and sisters. He was born into the so-called untouchable caste. And, well, he became a really important figure more generally in Indian history. He was one of the drafters of the Indian constitution. Towards the end of his life, converted to Buddhism and took a lot of his followers with him into Buddhism to free them from the hell of caste. So he's a very, very important figure. And he's a very important figure just in Triratna more generally. And he had many meetings with Sangharakshita, the founder of our community. And Sangharakshita did a lot of work in relation to those Buddhists. Yeah, so they were celebrating Dr. Ambedkar's conversion. And they were wondering, because they knew that we were Triratna Buddhists, and they knew from their community back in India that we have a connection. They were wondering if someone would go along to their celebration. So that was something Vajrasura did.
Yeah, so it was really, really lovely event, and it was a bit surreal. It was a bleary old day, wet and cold, and I was in this community centre just south of Dublin, and yet there was this beautiful Buddha shrine there and all these wonderful Indian people, mainly from Maharashtra in India, which is the province where Dr. Ambedkar converted to Buddhism. And we just did meditation together. We were presented with Indian dancing and culture. We chanted together, and then we just heard about Dr. Ambedkar. So it was such a nice connection to make with this group, and we've continued to deepen that connection with them. And in fact, I've met some people here in India who are connected with those Indian families living back in Ireland. So the connections, we live in a smaller world, don't we, in many ways. And it's just wonderful to see Ireland deepen these connections, become much more multicultural and enriched by all that.
Where's that? Can people come on retreat? Should we be here right now? When will it be available? What's it looking like at the start of 2025?
Great, yeah. So yeah, at the start of 2025, we just finished up a long period of going through the planning and all the various bureaucracy that happens, which can move quite slowly in Ireland, I'm afraid, sometimes. And we're optimistic now. We're hoping that this summer we can start building phase one, which is making this retreat centre usable, being able to run retreats for 17 or 18 people. And then we have to do another period of more fundraising. And then maybe in a year or two's time, we're hoping that all the stuff will be lined up and we'll start building phase two, which is a dedicated custom-built shrine room, some more beds for people to stay in, a much more comfortable retreat centre that'll increase the capacity up into the 20s, maybe 25 people or so. So by the end of this year, by the end of the summer, maybe you can come on retreat, and then more to look forward to in the future.
Well, it's really amazing that you are all making the Dharma a part of that in such a kind of manifest way. It's not just talk, you're making urban centres and now beautiful centres as part of the landscape. I like thinking of Shubhavihara as part of the landscape rather than in the landscape. It's almost like a natural feature. I hope somebody does discover it in 10,000 years' time, sort of smooth walled and rolling into the hills. And they'll kind of marvel at it.
We'll have to have a light passage at the solstice down and everything, you know.
That's right. Maybe you could, like, your face could lay up with it.
Probably have his relic somewhere, right?
That's right.
Or just his relic.
Maybe you could have Vajrasura painted as a chalk figure on the hillside, like that you can see from space or something like that.
Or all three of us there.
All three of you, yeah. The founders of Shubhavihara. Well, listen, thanks for coming and talking about it. It's sort of strange but also fitting that it's here in India. And, you know, the Dharma is totally transformative for people, like totally transformative. And all of this, the space we're in, and what was it, 700 people or something that are gathered here this week from all parts of the world, and very heavy presence from India, obviously. Just people who've turned their lives inside out through the story of the Dharma and the song of the Dharma. And it's so important that you hear all Jains together.
Yeah, they've used the Dharma to free themselves from,
yeah,
from the hell of caste. And for me, the idea of, well, there's so much suffering in Ireland, and let alone the world.
Yeah.
The idea of just giving people the opportunity, people that we will never meet, people in 100 years' time, in 500 years' time, the opportunity to free themselves from the hell of greed, hatred, and delusion. And that's what a great thing to do with our Thursday mornings and with our lives over the next few years. What a wonderful thing to do.
That is a legacy.
Well, congratulations. And again, if you want to help make it happen, if you want to be part of the story in a way, if you want to become a legendary figure as part of this project, you can go to dublinbuddhistcentre.org/dream and help dream it into reality. So thanks very much to Vajashura.
Thank you, Chandradasa. Yeah.
Thank you, Barabandhu.
Thank you, Chandradasa.
And thanks to Chair Sadayasihi.
Thanks. That's a pleasure as always.
He's making it happen. It's really wonderful to hear all of you. We'll be back with more stories soon on the podcast. And well, take care of each other. Take care of yourself. And as a special bonus, we're going to finish this episode with a recording specially made just for you of Sadayasihi reciting in Irish the 10 Buddhist precepts that govern ethical, kindly behavior. It's a very beautiful vision of the Buddhist path and exactly what Shubha Vihara is going to be about.
Le gníomhartha chuin canáltais, in glanam machorc. Le féile ón grí, in glanam machorc. Le suavnis simpliach agus sunas, in glanam machorc. Le cumarsáid éirinach, in glanam machuid cainte. Le bríthra cinálta, in glanam machuid cainte. Le bríthra cáircha, in glanam machuid cainte. Le bríthra siacha, in glanam mochid kainche. Le shéna sáncha agus shalvu suivnis, in glanam inchen. Le cool air ua agus aiger hasha, in glanam inchen. Le dibert anolish, a horn hagna, in glanam inchen.